Hello and welcome to the November 30th edition of Ukraine Without Hype. I am Anthony Bardaway, and it'll just be me this episode. This episode will be a news roundup, quite a few stories for us from the last 2 weeks. I would like to really recommend you go back to our previous episode where we interviewed Olga Tokariuk, who was one of the activists who was actually on the ground from the very first days of Euromaidan. It's been 10 years since the revolution. I think it's very important to look back what it was like at the time that started everything. But our topics this week, well, I'll just get the combat update out of the way right now. There was very little changes, very heavy fighting around Avdiivka still, very high casualty rates, very high loss rates, but no real changes in territorial losses or gains on any part of the front line. Everything I said in the update 2 weeks ago still holds right now, including the actual territory held. So we'll not be talking much about the battlefield update because of that. But we will go over the start of the winter and how that means in two different forms. Next, we'll go on to stories out of Russia that are quite predictable, but still stand out in how brazen they are in what I think is a time where it would be smarter for them to kind of even out things. Next, we'll be going into the attempted assassination of Mariana Budanova, the wife of Kirill Budanov, the head of the military intelligence. She's alive, she's recovering, but there was an assassination attempt on her via poisoning. And our headlining topic will be the Polish protests, the truckers blocking the border with Ukraine and preventing Ukrainian trucks from coming in or out of the country. And finally, in our positive news, I'm committing to ending every news update with a bit of positive news. The Scythian gold, the museum pieces that had been in a very prolonged legal battle that was finally won in June that we talked a little bit about at the time, has finally returned to Ukraine. But starting off with, I would like to turn your attention to another project that I was working on with the Kyiv Independent. I provided narration for a new documentary that just came out. This is the third documentary coming out of the War Crimes Investigation Unit at the Kyiv Independent. This one is titled Faces of Torture. As you can guess from the name and other documentaries as well from the War Crimes Investigation Unit, this is a tough watch, so you might need to be in the proper headspace for it, but is about the torture of Ukrainian soldiers held in Russian-controlled prisons. Specifically, this is mostly about the prisoners who were captured from the Battle of Mariupol and taken to Alenivka prison. Alenivka prison was then destroyed by what was likely a Russian missile, killing many of the people inside. But the story in the documentary is not just about that attack that killed so many, but also about the conditions of the prison itself, which were very brutal. Hence, Faces of Torture, Kyiv Independent, I'll be putting it in the show notes. But I think I'll call this first segment here the start of winter, both in a literal and more metaphorical sense. And there was this week a gigantic storm. It lasted a couple of days, but was worse over the weekend. They had kind of had storm of the century status. It mostly focused around the Black Sea. We got some of it in Kyiv. Not so much snow, but a lot of wind. It was a very loud night for wind. But the real damage was done, like I said, along the Black Sea coast region. Two people died in Odessa from damage due to the storm. But we also saw some incredible storm surges into Crimea. A lot of the infrastructure around the coastal area of Crimea was destroyed, including some of the defenses around Sevastopol Harbor and the Crimean Bridge. So maybe some advantage can be taken out of that, as well as around the Russian part of the Black Sea coast, especially Sochi. It was a very big one, very cold. And I think that has something to do with the fact that, as I said in the introduction, we are not seeing much forward movement on the front lines in any direction right now. The Ukrainian offensive is over by now, but the Russian offensive, which they had started in earnest a few weeks ago, The weather does not favor the offensive right now, let's just say. Going out of your trenches into a very powerful wind and snowstorm is not fantastic conditions to be on the attack in. So I'm pretty sure that is one factor why, even though the Russians had been kind of creeping along to the north of Avdiivka for a bit, nothing has changed. And I think that has something to do with the storm. So keep this in mind. One way for the winter to go well is for Ukrainian soldiers to have better winter equipment than Russian soldiers. So please go out there and donate to boots, uniforms, coats, socks, hand warmers. Every little bit counts fighting out in this open environment. And looks like will be a very harsh winter. Give our soldiers the best possible opportunity. But also, the other start of winter is that the Russians really began to attack Kyiv again. This had already happened with a missile strike relatively recently. But then on November 25th, we saw what could have been the largest drone attack on Kyiv of the war. There were 75 drones in total, though 74 of them were shot down. Some while they were on the way to Kyiv, and most of the rest over the city. It seems as though nobody was killed in this attack. Often falling debris, unfortunately, still is deadly. But there were 5 wounded, and there was a destroyed kindergarten. It was the video of the headmistress of the kindergarten was pretty sad. This is a woman who had worked there, you know, for years and years and years, really taking care of the kids there. But they've begun the process of trying to rebuild. And I hope that goes well for them because, you know, kids need a place to go. And this kindergarten seemed like it was very well loved that was destroyed. Now, most of these were shot down. Like I said, we really have to note the strength of the Ukrainian air defense. I'm also pretty confident that most missiles headed towards Kyiv will be intercepted, as they are. But we do have to note that the drones that were sent were an upgrade on the drones that we saw a few months ago. In particular, they did seem to have improved navigation systems. They used Ukrainian SIM cards to get Ukrainian wireless internet. Now, I'm not a tech guy for these kinds of things. In my mind, this seems like it could make them more easily tracked if it's possible to know what these SIM cards look like on some kind of something. I don't know. Out of my element. But those who know seem to say that this is in increased danger compared to how they were. The beginning of these attacks do herald what will likely be a winter campaign like we saw last winter of the Russians trying to destroy Ukrainian energy, electricity, heating, infrastructure in order to make us all miserable. Last winter sucked quite a lot. Though we are more prepared this time around, the Russians are probably going to try harder this time around as well. Ukrainian emergency services, electric companies, energy companies have been putting out messages reassuring the public that they are fully prepared for what is about to come, though there are some shortages in material, partially due to something I'll talk about later. So we do have to be very mindful of making sure that Ukraine gets the civilian supplies that are needed in order to keep civilization running, of generators, equipment for power plants, that kind of thing. Now, in response, Ukraine launched its own drone attacks against Russia. It seemed like most of the Ukrainian drones were shot down as well. Drones seem to be an issue of quantity more than anything else. Most drones will be shot down. Both Ukraine and Russia know the score of how to deal with drones by now. Especially after Russia had the embarrassing situation of having a drone explode over the Kremlin, they likely learned how to respond more after that. Though it is worth pointing out that Ukraine did blow up a drone warehouse in Bryansk. This warehouse in that location means that they are likely meant to attack Kyiv, and there goes a whole warehouse full of them that will no longer be a problem. So there we have it. The autumn is over. Today is the last day of November, and we are looking forward to another winter at war. But now looking at Russia, I said both of these stories were not surprising. And they really aren't. They just reiterated Russia's positions that are they've always had. And the first is that Putin gave another speech outlining his reasons for going to war, where he says that the purpose of the war is primarily in order to destroy Western hegemony, to create the multipolar world or whatever nonsense that they are calling it. The multipolar world where there's a collection of great powers who have to decide amongst themselves what to do with all the weak people of the world, divided up into their own little spheres of influence. 19th century concert of Europe. Of course, Russia sees itself as one of these great powers, even though really at this point they are just going to be subsumed under the Chinese sphere of control, but I don't know if they're fully ready to accept that. And the other part of it was that they want to reconstitute the full triune Rus people, meaning to reintegrate the great Russians or Russians, the Ukrainians and the Belarusians under a single empire. We've heard it all before. The only thing that confuses me a little bit is that at the same time, Russian information influence operations are really focusing on making it sound like Ukraine is the unreasonable one for not calling for a ceasefire. That, at least according to their Western messaging, what they would like to do is freeze the front line where it is, then give themselves time to rearm and attack again, but then present Ukraine as the warmongers. All the people in under the occupied territory want to be a part of Russia anyway, and the Ukrainians just insist on keep fighting, and that is how it's being presented in the Republican Party, for example, a lot of places in Europe. You would think that Russia would want to consolidate that messaging to say that, yes, we are only here to protect ourselves from NATO expansion or something. And then out comes Putin saying, no, we're here to rewrite the world order and destroy Ukraine as a nation, as well as Belarus. And, like, I understand that the Russiaversters in the West don't really base what they believe on anything in the real world, and I have not seen any reaction from them that makes them come to terms with what Putin just says out loud. Reality and what they want to believe are two entirely different things, or should I say what they choose to believe because it profits them in some way or another. But there are still, you know, the fence riders, and you would think that Russia would benefit from playing it minimalist right now as we see more and more cracks in the West for support for Ukraine. If they could wedge those cracks open by basically hiding their intentions. But no, they're just going full bore with it, almost as a dare. Like, we dare you to believe our lie while we tell you that we're lying to you. It's something that is very Russian and often works. But the other part of what's coming out of Russia right now that, again, is not surprising, but illustrative, is that the Russian Supreme Court declared the international LGBT rights movement as an extremist organization. So gay rights equals terrorism in Russia. They, of course, left this very vague. The far right is often not so intelligent when it talks about these things. The way that it sounds is like there is an actual, you know, organization here. There's not. So in practice, if Russia so chooses to use their ruling this way, it could mean anyone gay could be considered a terrorist, or anyone who thinks that gays should be equal is a terrorist. But of course, Ukraine, who is in the process of legalizing civil partnerships, are the far right crazy country and not Russia. But what I mean is, by this not being surprising, is of course Russia has always had its, for the last few years, Russia has had its quote-unquote gay propaganda law that makes it so any promotion of the gay agenda, whatever that means, can be considered unlawful in Russia. In many cases, people have been arrested for having a rainbow t-shirt or something. So the criminalization of being publicly gay is long-standing in Russia, but this is really a crackdown. And I think between these things, we are going to see a tightening up, a even further tightening up of the Russian authoritarian system as we go into the presidential elections next year. Many commentators are assuming that the authoritarianism come much worse after the election. Of course, he will win, and it will be presented as a popular consensus that Putin is right about everything and should have more power, and that the war is good and going well and should be continued. So there could even be, for example, mass mobilization as opposed to the limited mobilization that is going on now. So we should be prepared for that as well. If Russia chooses to go, you know, full Stalin on us, if they choose to go full mass mobilization, which is looking possible considering some of the other steps going on, the move towards greater and greater authoritarianism, it will be suicidal for Russia economically, but they don't care. And while Russia will crash and burn in trying to do this, it could take Ukraine down with it, just as Ukraine is losing support. So we really, really need that political support, equipment support that is being stalled out in U.S. Congress for not only this winter, but after the Russian elections in the early part of the year. Things could get worse, so we really need to be watching out for that. And this LGBT banning is a sign of that. Our next topic is an assassination attempt on Mariana Budanova, the wife of Kirill Budanov, head of military intelligence, or HUR. Reports came out that she had received heavy metal poisoning. This is likely mercury, but there are other possible culprits as well. Keep in mind that because we're talking about military intelligence right now and the family of the head of military intelligence, they are keeping this very close to their chests. They're not telling very many people. These are folks who are used to working in secrecy and do not leak very much. So we are dealing with the information we have, but what we know is that there was likely contamination at the HUR canteen, their cafeteria. Kirill Budanov and his family had been staying in their office because it's safer there, and just because Budanov has to be, you know, available at all times, there's no such thing as taking a weekend off for him. They had to be on site always. So they were eating at the cafeteria at the headquarters there, and apparently someone had slipped heavy metals into the food, which can cause things like, you know, kidneys to shut down. We don't really know what specifically it was, and they're not telling the symptoms, but heavy metal poisoning tends to have pretty predictable symptoms to it. She was not the only one who was affected. There were others as well, though due to the fact that this was a, you know, primarily male working environment, we're talking about people who are probably larger than her, which means better able to process heavy metal poisoning compared to a more slightly built woman. So she probably got the worst of it. But we do know that she is recovering. The poisoning was discovered. She went through treatment. These things can be flushed out of your system, though it is not very easy to do. Mercury and other heavy metals tend to live in the body, but can be dragged out by some methods, which is probably what they did. Again, just knowing about the condition, not knowing about her specific situation. The other employees are similarly recovering. It seems like nobody was killed and things were discovered in time. But what this does mean is that the headquarters of military intelligence was infiltrated by someone who was able to do the poisoning. And as the intelligence branch, this is a serious failing on their part that, let's just say that it's probably not a fantastic work environment right now. They are scrambling to find any contractor, any janitor, any dishwasher who could have been there to introduce poisoning into the food supply. And it is definitely a hunt. It's definitely a spy hunt right now, a very severe spy hunt that is sparing nobody. Attacking the family of the most dangerous man in Ukraine is not something that will go unpunished. There will likely be some kind of retaliation by HUR against Russian targets. We already saw that there was a strike against several high-ranking Russian officials who were in Kherson Oblast. I don't know if that's necessarily connected, but it is the kind of thing that military intelligence are very much interested in doing at the moment. We have been talking off and on about a clandestine war that has been occurring behind enemy lines, organized by Hur, and how this is likely to be the face of the more kinetic side of things as opposed to the strategic lock that we talked about when talking about the Zaluzhny op-ed, that these covert ops will become more and more important as the front line becomes more and more difficult to change. And in spy movie fashion, I can't imagine that the direct targeting of his wife will make Budanov less aggressive. But again, the immediate responsibility is to find out where the leak was and close it, because having Russian agents acting in such a sensitive and well-guarded part of the Ukrainian government is very concerning. And for our headline topic, the Polish protests, we had talked about this a little bit when in our previous news update. It was more of an aside because it had not become as big as it is now, and the various challenges of European integration, how that these were these protests happening. But now it's a real problem. So what's happening? So a collection of Polish truck drivers, calling themselves the Committee to Protect Transporters and Transport Employers, are having a large protest on the Ukraine-Polish border where they are preventing Ukrainian trucks from passing. Their immediate demand is that Ukrainian carriers will have to start paying for expensive licenses for access to EU markets, because the presence of Ukrainian trucking is outprice performing Polish trucking and driving prices for transport down. So on the surface, this is, you know, simple trade protectionism type stuff. There is a cheaper workforce in a poorer country, Ukraine, that is driving down the prices of a more expensive workforce in a more wealthy country, which is Poland. Though, as we said in that episode, though, the main reasons why Polish trucking is so successful is because they outprice compete other countries in the EU. So what's good for the goose is good for the gander sometimes. But here is where it gets a bit more conspiratorial. The head of this protest is Rafał Mekler. Rafał Mekler is the head of Rafał Mekler Transport. This transport company mainly dealt in business of trading with Russia and Belarus. So this guy had very, very deep business relationships with these countries, and the sanctions on Russia and Belarus has severely cut into his business. When he is used to being able to drive to Moscow and, you know, drop things off, pick things up, bring them back to the EU, and that being his main business, not being able to do that anymore is, of course, especially disruptive for him personally. This has also been part of the Polish truckers' broader complaints, is that because they lost out on business going to Russia and Belarus, that they should be made up for in some way. So there it is. The head of this protest is someone who has very deep business connections with Russia. But let's go a little bit deeper into that, because business interests typically go along with political interests. He is a very long-time supporter of Russia on a political stage. He was a supporter of the Russian annexation of Crimea and demanded that Poland and other countries recognize the annexation of Crimea, and he did this all the way back in 2014. Going further than that, he's very, very active in Polish nationalist anti-Ukrainian demonstrating. Now, we've talked about the fraught relationship between Poland and Ukraine on a historical level before, but he is one of those guys who really pushes the whole Ukrainians killed my grandpa type storyline. He is very active in protesting against Ukraine in the context of the Volyn massacres, and generally is recorded as saying a whole lot of racist stuff against Ukrainians. And on top of that, he is the head of the Lublin Region Confederacja Party. When we were talking about the Polish elections, we mentioned there was this one ultranationalist Polish party who would be the junior partner in a conservative Polish government that lost the elections, by the way. But he is very much a part of this party and in part of the country that is one of the strongest. And Lublin, Confederatio is very strong. And, you know, the border with Ukraine, the southeast part of the country, that's more rural, more conservative. So while he definitely presents himself here as just after this one small little thing of introducing licenses for Ukrainian truckers, really, it takes very little scratching at the surface to see where he's really at. He is part of a political party that has been very friendly and pro-Russian. He himself has done a lot of pro-Russian and anti-Ukrainian political organizing. He almost is treating this as a game where people will be responding to him by saying, well, you're clearly acting in Russia's interests. And then he'll do, you know, ooh, not me. I'm just a poor little boy who's just after this one little thing. It's infuriating how much he knows that we know, and we know that he knows that we know that he is working for Russia here. And he even does like winky face emojis when he does this in his Twitter posts. It's very sad how blatant this is, considering that the next part here, very little's being done about it. As I said, this is the party that Law and Justice, the current-ish ruling party, will need to form a government after they lost to the opposition in these most recent elections. But because Law and Justice had the most number of votes, they get the first try at forming a government, even though it's going to fail. Everyone knows it's going to fail. By custom, they are permitted to have time to try to get parties to their side, despite the votes just not being there. So they are very so Law and Justice is very much dragging their feet, sucking up to the far right, and overall just trying to make as much of a problem for the next government as possible. So in this case, the government could do something to break up a blockade of their borders by these protesters who are very obviously working in the interests of Russia, and they're just doing absolutely nothing about it. They're doing very little, even in the way of diplomacy, to calm the problem down. So I really do think that the current Polish government is just trying to create as many problems for the next incoming Polish government to have to deal with early next year. And in response, just recently, Ukrainians have begun their own blockade, preventing traffic on the Polish side of the border. There's some complaints from Przemyśl that they're now causing some traffic jams around the city. So it's definitely heating up as a conflict, and the Polish government is failing entirely to do anything about it. And this is not just about blocking trucks. The most immediate problem is that two Ukrainians have already died in these traffic logs of just being stuck out on the road. They can't go any further because of this blockade, and due to the weather, due to the stress, due to who knows, two Ukrainian truckers have died, both of them in their 50s that I saw. And beyond that, this also means that humanitarian aid is having much more trouble entering Ukraine. There have been complaints from various groups that they're not getting things like generators for the winter. They're not getting medical supplies. They're not getting many of the things that they need because of this blockade. I mentioned that there were shortages of equipment for repairing the energy infrastructure. This is not helping. Some stuff is still going through, though there are times when the blockade is absolute and nothing gets through. They claim that they are allowing anything by that is directly marked as humanitarian aid, although one, that's not true, and two, many things that are still very much needed in this country are not explicitly registered legally as humanitarian aid. Personal generators, for example, a lot of things don't go through the extra hoops of being officially declared humanitarian because there isn't supposed to be any kind of limit on them entering the country anyway. And again, the cheekiness that they're taking with this is very obnoxious, where they know that they're blocking humanitarian aid, and when confronted with it, they prevent this weird Soviet legalistic argument of, oh, you didn't have these papers. It's not your job to check the correct papers. You're just some guy. Anyway, this is something I'm very angry about. Poland and Ukraine are very close countries. Most of the people in Poland are very supportive of Ukraine. But there is this segment as being taken advantage of in order to create more problems, to basically blackmail Polish-Ukrainian relations for whatever thing that they want. And in this case, taking advantage of some economic complaints to very obviously add Russian influence to it. And on top of that, again, the lack of the Polish government doing anything to fix it. And because I take everything back to history, we have to remember why Poland was destroyed in the first place back in the 1700s, which was the magnates, these wealthy businessmen who controlled the Polish Commonwealth. Most of them had been bought out by Russia. So here we go again, Rafał Meckler repeating the mistakes of the past. And because every Pole should know about how this happened, doing it very deliberately, because he wants the result from the partitions of Poland to happen once again of Russia swallowing up Eastern Europe, including Poland. Will it get to that point? I don't think so. But history, it rhymes. And is in Poland's best interest to realize what's happening as it's happening and treat people like Rafał Meckler as the traitors that they are. And now finishing off with our positive story, which is needed for both me and you. So back during the seizure of Crimea by Russia, at the time, there were several museums in Crimea that were loaning out a very large collection of ancient artifacts to museums in the Netherlands. This is called the Scythian gold case, because even though not all the artifacts were Scythian and not all the artifacts were gold, Scythian gold was most of it put together. There's also Sarmatian and some other early Bronze Age civilizations thrown in, some statues, but Scythian gold. We'll just call it Scythian gold. Now, because these museums were in Crimea and the administration of these museums had fallen under Russian control during the annexation, the illegal annexation of Crimea, Russia declared that the artifacts belonged to them. However, they were part of the Ukrainian government cultural ministry, and therefore they belonged to the Ukrainian government, even if they were part of any specific museum that fell under the control of a different government, the stuff was still the Ukrainian government's. So there's this long, long, long court case to decide who these artifacts belonged to. Most of the time, the wind was behind the Ukrainians in their case, but law moved slowly. And it wasn't until June that they made the final decision that yes, these artifacts belong to Ukraine and should be sent back to Ukraine. So that happened in June. We talked a little bit about it at the time, but now the big update now is that these artifacts have been confirmed as arriving in Kyiv. The National Museum of the History of Ukraine says that is now officially in the possession of the Ukrainian state once again, and that they had arrived at the Kyiv-Pechersk Lavra. The Lavra, we've mostly talked about it in the past as a, you know, religious site, the most important cathedral in the country, but also there are a ton of museums in there. It's a very large complex, so that could be where they're going. It's also a pretty secure place, you know, caverns and all that. You could store some valuable materials during a bombing raid. So they're all back. 565 items, Scythian, Sarmatian, gold, statues, worth a lot of money, back in Ukraine after this long legal fight with Russia in Dutch courts. That really goes to highlight once again how much value Russia puts on the cultural side of this war. Now, primarily, this is about money. As you can imagine, hundreds of pieces of gold from, you know, 2,000 plus years ago is worth quite a bit. So Russia would want all that just for that reason. Money, money, money. But also, Russia has put a lot of emphasis on their monopoly on history in the area as well. Ukraine cannot have a history independent of Russia, according to them. And one way that they have decided to go about executing that idea is by taking control of Ukraine's physical heritage. To have Ukraine's physical heritage in their possession also means having control of Ukraine's heritage in general, from their point of view. And so, in all of these cities that Russia goes into, one of the first places that they go after is the local history museum, taking artifacts, paintings as well. And because we're talking about the south of Ukraine, where there's tons of Scythian, Sarmatian, etc., archaeological sites, a lot of this has been that kind of that kind of artifact. Russia's taken a lot of Scythian, Sarmatian, Cimmerian artifacts into their possession that belong to Ukraine. A lot of the time, the directors of the museums have tried to defend the collections. And because of that, a lot of museum directors are dead or had to go into hiding. The director of the Melitopol Museum comes to mind immediately. The name blanking, but she tried to hide the artifacts from the Russians, who showed up again very first day to take the valuable stuff. Tried to hide it. It was found. Her family tortured. She escaped to Ukrainian-controlled territory because she would have been killed. The archaeological, historical side of this fight is very important, and Russia definitely considers it very important, and Ukraine just had a win on that battlefield. So that's all the news we have for you for this episode. If you'd like to support Ukraine Without Hype, tell your friends about us, like, subscribe, 5-star, thumbs up, whatever the version of that is on however you're listening to us. If you'd like to support Ukraine more generally, you can go to our Linktree and find other sources of information, charities, ways to learn more and support Ukraine. If you'd like to support us financially, you can go to patreon.com/UkraineWithoutHype and join one of our tiers of support. This includes being able to join our Discord channel where you can ask us questions, give us topics to talk about. We want to know what you want to know to help make the podcast better. And that's the best way to do it. So I'd now like to thank our Patreon supporters. Thank you very much to Deborah Grazer. The voices in my head are from Big Pharma. David Shepard, Giorgio, Ivana Kratskyle, Michael Druker, Anna Karen Person, Anonymous, Dennis Napalm, Devi, Dimitri Levin, Etienne, James Burke, Jan, Genera, Jenny Louise, Kevin Alberton, Marguerite, Michael Wickman, Mike Perrone, PLM, Shieldwall, Silas Frank, T. Bart, Vivek, Adam Poppenheimer, Aiden McDowell, Alex Grochmal, Anastasia, Barbara, Captain Technical, Chris Bennington, Daniel Spring, David Wall, Emily Bavona, Grace Krause, Had to Laugh, Jacob Holm, James Wise, Jared Bailey, Jerd, Julia Lindsay, Laura DeLeon, Levy Grove, Marianne, Matt Miller, Melissa Koselko, Anonymous, Noam Hart, Paul Bailey, Rennie McNerlin, RDK, Sandra Bongers, Sanjay, Scott Berry, Scott Gengris, Scott Tarkayuk, Steve Bien, Stuart Akers, Subtle Knife, Thomas Sobiek, Veronica, Victoria Leontineva, and Wandering Lens. Thank you all very much who helped make this all possible. So until next week, Slava Ukraini!